You're listening to the Hayek Program Podcast. This podcast includes audio from lectures, interviews, and discussions from scholars and visitors of the F.A. Hayek Program for Advanced Study in Philosophy, Politics, and Economics at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. To learn more about the Hayek Program, visit hayek.mercatus.org. To learn about graduate student fellowship opportunities with the Mercatus Center at George Mason University, for students at Mason as well as at universities across the globe, please visit students.mercatus.org.
Hello, and welcome to the Hayek Program Podcast. I'm Nathan Goodman, and I'm a senior fellow here at the Hayek Program. Today, I'm speaking to my friend and colleague, Abby Hall. Abigail R. Hall is an associate professor of economics at the University of Tampa. She is also a senior affiliated scholar here at the Mercatus Center and a senior fellow at the Independent Institute. Her research focuses on Austrian economics, public choice, and defense and peace economics. She is the author of several books, including Tyranny Comes Home, The Domestic Fate of U.S. Militarism, Manufacturing Militarism, and How to Run Wars, a Confidential Playbook for the National Security Elite. Today, she joins me for another episode of our series on immigration. Abby, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me. My pleasure.
I want to begin with your first book, Tyranny Comes Home. So in that book, you and Chris Coyne describe what you call the boomerang effect, and you explain how it's impacted domestic civil liberties in various arenas. Now, one arena that's especially salient to me that you discuss a bit in that book is how the boomerang effect impacted U.S. border policies. So what is the boomerang effect, and how has it impacted U.S. border policy?
So the boomerang effect is, as you mentioned, a framework that my co-author and I developed to describe the following phenomenon: how it is that the tools and tactics that are developed as a part of foreign intervention come to be used domestically. So the standard narrative usually goes something like this: foreign policy is foreign policy, domestic policy is domestic policy, and ne'er the two shall meet. But what we are highlighting with that book as a whole and with this framework is that these two spheres are not separate. And in fact, a lot of what is happening abroad can and does come to be used at home, even within the context of a constrained democracy. So in that framework, we identify various channels of the boomerang effect. So we talk about human capital, just being the skills, attitudes, et cetera, that people possess. We highlight physical capital, so the actual tools of war or foreign intervention. So this can range from things like torture techniques to things like UAVs or drones or other types of military technologies. And then we also talk about what we refer to as administrative dynamics, which we can think of as just the institutional structures that are constructed to carry out foreign intervention that can then wind up being implemented domestically. So within the context of U.S. border policy, there are a few ways that this might come through. So we could talk about the militarization of border policing, which you would probably be able to speak on better than I could. And then the other place that we really see it, and this is something that we discuss a little bit in the book, though it's not the primary focus, is you see almost immediately when UAVs or drones are being deployed in the war on terror starting in 2002, you see them also start to be used almost simultaneously along the U.S. southern border with Mexico. And so we see these tools of foreign intervention coming home to be used domestically. And within the case of border policy, we said surveillance technologies would be one, but then we could talk about militarization as well.
Yeah, I think that's really important. And it really illustrates how these sectors that people see as separable, these policy areas people see as separable, are not so separable. And there's arguably another degree of permeability between U.S. border policy and more interior domestic policing, of course, because as you know, unmanned aerial vehicles or drones were used initially for foreign policy, then brought to the border, and now the Border Patrol fairly frequently lends them to other police agencies internally to the United States.
Yes, that's exactly right. And there's some other bleed, there's some other like areas of bleeding over or just crossover in policy arenas, because when people find out that I study defense topics very broadly, and then if I'm working on an immigration paper, people are wondering, well, what does this have to do with what does immigration have to do with, you know, war or defense policy? But one of the things that we've seen, not just contemporarily, but certainly within, I'd say, the last 10 years or so, we see this increasing supposed tie between immigration and terrorism or national security threats. And so here again, we see this crossover between what appears to be one policy and what appears to be another policy, but we find that they're intimately interlinked.
Yeah, and it seems like some of that we can trace back to the beginnings of the war on terror, right? Because they restructured a lot of U.S. border policy as part of early stages of the war on terror, right? So initially, the Immigration and Naturalization Service was within the Department of Justice, and then they split that up into a couple of different component parts, which were put under the auspices of the Department of Homeland Security, right?
Right. And when you see the creation of DHS, which, if memory serves me correctly, kind of subsumes like 22 other agencies kind of under its broader umbrella, you do see this kind of, again, just massive restructuring and this real kind of fundamental pivot in a lot of existing organizations to kind of, again, retool their mission statement or to retool what it is they're doing to kind of meet the overarching goals of the more concentrated federal government.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Robert Higgs wrote a fair bit about that around when it was starting to happen, right? He had already written a lot on the military-industrial congressional complex, but then started to write on the security-industrial congressional complex to talk about the growth of the Department of Homeland Security.
Sure. Bob Higgs definitely would be one. And then the other person that I would point people to if they want to read about that specifically would be John Mueller and his work on the kind of terrorism complex.
Yeah, absolutely. Very important work there. So in addition to your broad work on the national security state, which, as we've discussed here, has some implications that are pretty important for border policy and immigration policy, you've also done specific research on border policy and immigration policy, where that's the primary focus. So for example, in research with co-authors such as Michael Kuhn, Cynthia Bonsack, and Suzanne Zieringer, you analyzed the consequences of the Secure Fence Act of 2006. So what did the Secure Fence Act do, and what were the results?
So the Secure Fence Act of 2006 effectively authorized the creation and expansion of a border wall in, again, along the southern border of the U.S. And in that work, my co-authors and I have done a couple different things. So in one paper, we looked at what happened when certain areas of fence were built. So it's important for people here to know kind of how border fencing has been constructed, because people often think, and perfectly reasonably, like if you're going to build a fence around your house, you're going to like start with posts, but you're going to go from one end to the other. You're not going to like start in the middle of your yard, build 2 feet of fence, and then go, you know, 5 feet over and build another 2 feet of fence, and then go 5 feet over and build another 2 feet of fence. But when you're talking about the U.S. southern border, that is what you see. So you see that fences are constructed not kind of in sequence or not from one end to the other, but it's piecemeal construction. And so what we did was we looked to see when and where these fencing areas were put up. We also looked at different types of fencing, so pedestrian fencing, vehicle fencing. And then we looked to see what happened with death rates. And so we had a data set that we utilized on the border between Arizona and the U.S. And so using that data, we looked to see what did it do to migratory patterns, or what can we deduce about migratory patterns based on where the fence is built and then looking at where it is that people have died. And so in kind of the first paper that we looked at, what we basically found was that the construction of the fence, as opposed to completely deterring people from trying to cross, it essentially just detoured them. They crossed in different places, so they crossed a little bit further away from where they probably would have, and then they might have also chosen to cross in like a completely different area. Importantly, these areas, this is from this paper and a second one that's currently under review, what we observed is that these migratory patterns changed in such a way that migrants are now crossing in more dangerous areas than what they would have been crossing previously. So more dangerous take to be things like further distance from a main highway or longer distance from any type of population area, crossing in a desert or crossing in places with high elevation. And so what we've observed is, again, this difference in terms of where people are crossing, but then also seeing kind of significant clusters in terms of casualties. So it not only appears that people are, again, deterring to these more dangerous migratory routes, but they're also dying in these new routes as well.
So there's some very serious humanitarian consequences, obviously, of this analysis. But I think it's somewhat worth stepping back and thinking about how this reflects certain insights related to price theory, which might seem crude to some listeners for us to talk about when it comes to thinking about people dying, but people respond to incentives, and that's sort of the logic of what the policymakers intend with this. They're thinking, okay, we want to deter migration. So Gary Becker on the economics of crime, for any action, including an action that's prohibited, demand curves slope downward. And if you raise the cost, people will do less of it. But what you're noting is that, yes, people will do less of what you've raised the cost of, but what they'll substitute towards is not necessarily legal compliance. They might substitute towards a more dangerous way of violating the law. So people are, advocates of the policy are right that there's a substitution effect and that people respond to incentives, but they're not necessarily thinking about all the margins of substitution that people can act on. Is that a fair way of summarizing what's going on?
I think that is. And so it is exactly that. It's the, instead of seeing deterrence as policymakers purport to want, that you're just going to deter people from migrating completely, you see them just, again, substituting. So they say, okay, if I can't cross here, then I'm going to go cross over here. And so, as you highlight, I think appropriately, is that there are real humanitarian costs associated with that. At the end of the day, economic cost and human cost are fundamentally interlinked. So we don't just talk about, you know, monetary cost and pretend that those aren't human costs. But that's exactly what you see, is you see this substitution toward these more dangerous migratory routes. We also did note some potential differences maybe in composition of who was crossing. So you tend to see like more single men crossing as opposed to like families, but you're not necessarily seeing a reduction in crossings. It is important to note too that when we study illegal immigration or we study illegal border crossing, we don't have like numbers that we can look at for crossings. We have to proxy with apprehensions. And so one of the things that I think is just relevant, and we certainly talk about this in our papers, but anytime we're talking about migration patterns, the numbers that we have are estimates. Some are better than others, but we're not seeing really any, at least attributable, decline in apprehensions as a result of the policy.
That makes sense. So it seems like, as you're noting here, there are certain data limitations when you're dealing with a set of actions that are prohibited, and therefore people have incentives to try to render these actions illegible to the state. So how do you think about doing research on topics where your subjects necessarily don't want to be fully recorded and observed by external authorities?
And that's certainly a challenge. So for these two particular papers that we've been discussing, we've utilized primarily data from Arizona, which is particularly granular. So we have things like how many feet of fencing were built in a given year. We know exactly where they were built. And then we also have death records, which we can look at. Other studies, I think the Mexican Migration Project like keeps track of quite a bit of data that they get from surveys on, I think it's an annual basis. But certainly there are data limitations. So for these two papers that we've been working on, we've employed different empirical strategies. One of them, we use GIS data, and we construct what's called a hotspot analysis to basically look at statistically significant clusters of where it is that people are dying after crossing. But then sometimes too, when looking at these topics where data is not comprehensive or data is insufficient to be able to perform the statistical analyses that we might want to, then we have to start thinking about alternative methodologies. And so one of the ways that I often think about it and will explain it to people who ask is if we run into a data problem, but we have a really good question, we don't have to abandon economics just because our econometrics aren't appropriate or won't function the way we want them to. We need to pivot. So we can take our economic tools and apply them to the question. We just need to do it in a different way. So then you see things like analytical narratives becoming an important research tool to be able to kind of bridge that gap between, hey, this is a question where economics has something important to say, but we can't use our statistical tools.
Yeah, absolutely. So it seems like you're very much driven by the questions rather than the method, and you're sort of rebelling against a tendency some social scientists have to search for their keys under a streetlight, even though they lost them in a dark alley three blocks away.
I always teach my students that the question drives the methodology and not the other way around. And so it just so happens that a lot of the questions that I find particularly interesting are not ones that are easy to deploy a statistical method to solve. But I am very much a proponent of still analyzing and looking at those questions. So I really do embrace a methodological pluralism. Use the tool that's appropriate for the question.
Yeah. So if the Secure Fence Act caused increased migrant deaths rather than simply deterring migration, what are some alternative policies that might have better consequences?
So there are a few things that we could talk about here. There's the if I could wave a magic wand type of policy, and then there's more kind of practical policies. In terms of what I personally would like to see is a much more open immigration policy, where you have much more easier routes for people to migrate legally, which I think kind of contrary to maybe a lot of more anti-immigration or people who are proponents of stricter immigration policies. A bit counterintuitively, I think open immigration would solve a lot of the problems that opponents of immigration purport to really care about. In terms of more kind of practical policies, you could do things like allowing for more visas to be issued. There is an incredible backlog of visas in the United States. So off the top of my head, it's something like if you were issued a visa as a Mexican citizen in the 1990s, you're now getting your visa. It's 2025. So you are talking about, really for all intents and purposes, a lifetime or a generation past from when you are approved to when you actually get your visa. There's also some really clear problems with our contemporary asylum policies, which could also be changed in order to kind of facilitate an easier migratory journey for many people, but again, also kind of solve some of these more clerical problems or these logistical problems that the U.S. government has when it comes to facilitating or looking at migrants.
Excellent. Yeah. So you mentioned problems with our asylum policies, and that's something that you've written about in a paper in Peace Review with Michael Kuhn and Cassie Bricker. So what does current U.S. asylum policy or U.S. asylum policy at the time that you were writing that paper look like? And what challenges does asylum policy present for U.S. policymakers and the Border Patrol?
So without getting too deeply into the weeds about what kind of led us to the place where we currently are, the Cliff Notes version is that asylum is now sometimes one of the very, very few ways that a migrant can come to the U.S. and obtain legal status. Now, there are two different types of asylum. There is what's called affirmative asylum. So say that somebody comes from El Salvador or Honduras, they come to the U.S., they surrender themselves at a point of entry, they tell, say, the border agent, you know, I want to claim asylum. And that's supposed to kick off a process where they are, you know, reviewed, they go in front of a judge, like they have their case heard. Then on the other hand, you have what's called defensive asylum, which say that somebody is already in the U.S., they get picked up by customs and or they get picked up by Border Patrol, and then they try to claim asylum. So why is it that people might try to claim asylum? They're fleeing their country. They have to have what's called credible fear. So something in their country is preventing them from from returning, or they have an expectation that it would be harmful to them if they were to return to their country. And so affirmative asylum cases are relatively, and I use the term relatively kind of in scare quotes, are relatively easier for migrants to employ than defensive asylum cases. But really, in the last, say, 15 to 20 years, you've seen a marked increase in the number of asylum cases. Again, because the way that policies have shifted, it's really one of the only avenues for many migrants to try to obtain legal status in the U.S. Being or waiting for your asylum case to be heard means that migrants can often do things like get a driver's license, they can get work permits while they wait. And so that's kind of the contemporary arena surrounding asylum policy. But then just like you have with visas, there's a huge backlog of asylum cases. So in many instances, people are waiting years to have their asylum cases heard.
Yeah. So in some sense, the root cause here seems to be the lack of legal pathways in general. And that generates an incentive for lots and lots of people to claim asylum and to, in the process, often perhaps cross without going through anything legally prior to coming. Is that fair to say?
I think that that's a fair categorization. And it's, I think it's important to highlight too, that even though the US compared to other countries still does have a fairly liberal immigration policy, that in no way implies that it is easy to immigrate to the United States. And even in the most kind of like shortest case scenario or the easiest path, you are still talking about years of paperwork and interviews. And again, that is best case scenario. But if you are somebody who is fleeing persecution or you're fleeing poverty, if you are, say, again, from Honduras or you're from Venezuela, you're going to have a really rough time going and trying to come to the U.S. in any other way other than coming and claiming asylum.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's also worth noting that when it comes to alternative pathways, right, David Beer of the Cato Institute has done research where he finds that basically 99% of people who would like to come to the U.S. have no legal pathway available for them. So immigration is very heavily restricted under existing U.S. policies. So in terms of dealing with the backlog of asylum claims and some of the other challenges that it presents, there have been various attempts to do so. And one policy that was implemented to deter unauthorized crossing and to speed up adjudication of asylum claims and removal of asylum seekers whose claims weren't accepted was called Operation Streamline. So what is Operation Streamline and what were its effects?
So Operation Streamline was a policy that was implemented in the United States, again, to, as you mentioned, try to clear the backlog of asylum cases. So it effectively made it a federal crime for people to cross the U.S. border illegally. And so there are different penalties for people who it's their first offense, so their first illegal crossing or subsequent illegal crossings. So I believe that if I recall correctly, the jail sentence can be up to, say, like 2 to 3 years. And after somebody's sentence is served, they are immediately deported. Now, the other kind of important component of this policy is that it allows for many people to have their cases heard, quote unquote, simultaneously. So up to 70 people can have their cases heard at the same time. This leads to a lot of guilty pleas, and so you have a lot of deportations as a direct result. So here again, you see what the intended purpose of the policy is to try to streamline these cases, but it doesn't take a whole lot for us to think about maybe some of the problems that would be encountered by hearing 70 cases at a time. And using that as your mechanism to try to clear your caseload.
Yeah, it seems like that really removes a lot of the benefits of getting your day in court, a lot of the benefits in terms of due process as a constraint on the exercise of coercive government power. So it seems like there's really serious civil liberties concerns, and it also seems like there are some unintended consequences. Can you speak on sort of both of those?
Yeah, so in terms of things like the unintended consequences, like there's certainly a lot that we can think about. So again, you think about things like evasion cost, how people are trying to enter into the U.S. So if, again, trying to claim asylum is really hard, then maybe you don't go and surrender yourself at a legal port of entry and you try to immigrate, you know, illegally and then take your chances and then try to claim defensive asylum. But one of perhaps the biggest unintended consequences that my co-authors and I highlight is, one, you have real opportunity cost in terms of resources. So if Customs and Border Patrol are just trying to like round up people who are trying to claim asylum, or you're trying to get all of these people together to hear these massive asylum cases, what could they be doing instead? But also related to this is that with the system that we have now, where you effectively incentivize, I think as you mentioned a moment ago, like 99% of migrants who couldn't have or don't have a way of migrating to the US legally. If you're looking, or if your policies are so restrictive that now you're just having to round up people who are not a threat in any capacity, you know, they don't have any ties to criminal organizations, they're otherwise law-abiding citizens. They've entered the U.S. looking for, like most migrants do, better opportunities, a more stable or more prosperous life for themselves, for their families and their children. You're focusing your resources on those individuals, which most people are probably not particularly concerned about. I don't lose any sleep at night thinking about the families from Mexico or Venezuela who've migrated to the U.S. in search of work. What we might consider, though, is that if we're generally putting resources toward looking at those individuals, who are we not looking at instead? And so one of the things that we highlight by these policies is that, counterintuitively, again, if you had a more relaxed immigration policy and people were able to migrate more freely, then that would actually free up resources on the part of Customs and Border Patrol to be able to actually look and see, okay, why are you still crossing illegally? Because we've got now these different paths for people to come to the U.S. legally. So who are going to be the people left that are going to have to use illicit channels? Those are going to be the people who are engaging in trafficking, smuggling, or other types of nefarious behavior, in which case you can channel your resources more effectively.
Yeah, I think that one thing that gets at is economics still applies when we're talking about the provision of security. It's not as though security efforts are a free lunch. The time of any police officer or Border Patrol agent is scarce. The resources and equipment used are scarce resources that can't be used for looking at one person when they're being used for looking at another. So this genuine rivalry between alternative uses of scarce resources is occurring in a non-priced environment. And right now we're allocating a lot of resources towards policing peaceful people who aren't doing anything to harm anyone. So how could we encourage better resource allocation in a non-priced and politically administered bureaucratic environment like this?
Oh, man. that is a really tough question, because here the incentives are just so poorly aligned. So there are a few different things that I think of primarily from a public choice or an economics of politics perspective. So I think about things like the economics of bureaucracy and the tendency of bureaucracies to try to continuously expand, to push beyond their initial mission. So what we refer to as mission creep. It's certainly not something that only happens within the context of government bureaucracies, but it's particularly salient within the context of bureaucracies, in which case, you know, immigration and customs enforcement would be a prime example of that bureaucracy. And I think that if people look at the budget that's been allocated to ICE over the last 25 years, you can see that expansion relatively easily. Other like challenges to fixing this issue too. Immigration tends to be pretty politically divisive. And so you have US voters who are going to feel very differently about immigration. Different constituency groups have very different feelings about immigration. But also the people who are primarily affected, immigrants or would-be immigrants, they don't get a say in the US political process. And so it's not as though the policies implemented by the U.S., which are directly affecting migrants or potential migrants, they don't get a say in that process. So we could talk about things like the U.S. prison system, which is effectively a breeding ground for, say, MS-13 membership in El Salvador. We don't talk about kind of how, okay, U.S. policies wind up putting people in prisons, then people get deported, which then effectively exports gang members back to their country of origin, which then just fuels the migration of people fleeing the gangs in, again, we could talk about El Salvador, we could talk about Honduras and other places certainly as well. And so you've got a lot of kind of really complex interwoven problems that I don't think are particularly easy to solve in any one way. And in terms of, like I said, how do you make it function better? I mean, the easy and difficult answer is that the incentives are messed up and you have to align the incentives. But I think that that is a really tall order. And it, as an exercise in humility, I will not pretend to know the magical answer to how we go about fixing the policy or fixing the current institutional structures, at least as they are. I think that that's a really challenging thing to do.
I mean, one thing you mentioned in your answer there is the sort of negative spillovers that U.S. criminal justice and deportation policies have had on gang violence in El Salvador, which then had various impacts on migratory flows. But of course, as you and I have written about with Carlos Segovia and with Miriam Reyes Sandoval, right, the U.S. government has a long history of imposing severe and brutal negative externalities on people in El Salvador. And so people who are just looking at contemporary news stories about CECOT or about MS-13 might miss some of that history. So this wasn't in the questions that I sent you initially, but would you be open to discussing a little bit some of the history of U.S. government's intervention in El Salvador and some of its consequences for contemporary immigration policy?
Sure. And there's a lot of things that we could talk about, not just in El Salvador, although, of course, that's been where the research we've worked on together has really focused. But if you look at the history of the U.S. involvement in, let's say, Latin America, very generally, so you talk about Central America and South America, and then some people will include the Caribbean in that as well. There's a long history of intervention. So you go back to the Monroe Doctrine, which talks about, you know, spheres of influence, basically telling all of Europe that they can leave this hemisphere alone, that this is within the purview of the United States. And then you talk about like the Roosevelt corollary on top of that. You've got a lot of history of intervention. So whether we want to talk about, you know, the Contras in Nicaragua, or we want to talk about, you know, Pinochet in Chile, we can talk about those. But within the context of like Central America, so El Salvador specifically, some of the most relevant things that we could look at relate to the Cold War period. And so during the Cold War, you have this interesting dynamic where you see, as you do other places globally, you have these kind of like proxy wars that are being fought between the US and the Soviet Union. So El Salvador specifically is interesting because you have the Farabundo Martí Liberation Front, or FMLN, who is this communist group who is attempting to gain power in El Salvador. And then you have the US government, who is effectively backing the government of El Salvador, as well as their armed forces. So this includes sending things like weapons and also providing a great deal of military training for the armed forces of El Salvador, and then intensive humanitarian consequences. And so El Salvador's civil war, I think, is the second longest civil war in the history of Latin America, second only to Guatemala. So you do see this incredibly long history of U.S. involvement in Latin America. But for our purposes, specifically linking it back to immigration, we can think about U.S. involvement as kind of providing the fuel for a lot of contemporary issues related to immigration. So in thinking about El Salvador specifically, you have, you know, again, the U.S. who is providing the training, who is providing the weaponry for the armed forces who are the primary aggressors in terms of like civilian casualties when we look at that data. But it's not just there. It's other places as well. We could also talk about, say, like Venezuela and policies of sanctions or other U.S. policies which are currently impacting the Venezuelan economy, which, of course, the Maduro regime has done a great job of running its own economy into the ground. So this is not to place the blame solely at the feet of the U.S. government, but it's certainly a part of the discussion. And so a lot of the waves of immigration that we're seeing are tied directly to historical U.S. policy. So in some ways, the U.S. government is seeing the results of the programs that it's implemented in the past.
Yeah, and I think one thing that's tricky about that first is that people have imperfect foresight, so they don't anticipate all these consequences when they're starting. And second, it's not as though the U.S. government is a stable set of actors that directly bears these costs, right? The people who made the decisions that involved arming and funding and training the Salvadoran military and the paramilitary death squads that were acting in El Salvador during the Civil War, they're not the people who are going to necessarily face voters' backlash when you see a wave of immigration later that can perhaps be traced through a train of reasoning to that. So it's tricky.
Yeah, and it's not only that. It's that most people would not like make that connection between contemporary migration patterns and policies that were in effect in the 1980s. And that's not to say that voters are stupid or that people aren't paying attention. It's just not a particularly clear and immediate causal link. So one of the things that's a theme in a lot of my own research, the piece that I've done on immigration included, is that a lot of the important effects of foreign policy are nonlinear and they're not immediately apparent. So they're indirect or secondary effects. We might also refer to them as system effects. So you see interventions in one part of a complex system. Another country would certainly be a complex system. And then you wind up generating changes or altering other parts of that system. And as you mentioned, it's very difficult, if not impossible, for policymakers to see those beforehand. And then even if we want to go back through and look at these chains, we often can't see them immediately. It takes time for them to emerge. And then in the context of Latin America specifically, and this is something that is both exciting as well as really challenging about working on data or working on kind of questions related to Latin America, is that a lot of the data that we have is really poor. So in the case of El Salvador, we have some of the quote unquote best data from their civil war period. But even then, the data is not particularly great. So it's not something that you could easily do a statistical analysis on, even though it's quote unquote, you know, the best data. Then you start going and looking at other places, or you attempt to go even further back in time, and just there is a paucity of data.
Absolutely. So given the complexity of the systems involved and the pervasiveness of these system effects, right, it seems like every conceivable policy is likely to generate some set of unintended and unanticipated consequences. So how can people moving forward think about what might do the least harm, given that there are going to be unanticipated, unintended consequences of any action?
And that's absolutely right. So economics can't tell us what policy is right or what policy it's wrong, but it can inform us about what trade-offs exist. We have a really clear picture now of what historical and contemporary policy looks like. So this very restrictive immigration policy has led us to what we currently have. We have a backlog of asylum cases. We have a backlog of visas. We have families which have been split apart, which still have yet to be reunified. And we have a real problem with our current processes. And this is true regardless of whether you think we should have more immigration, less immigration, or the same amount of immigration. We can acknowledge that the current policies have presented some real problems. Going forward, I think that it's important for us to start with, and this again is true, regardless of kind of where you come down on immigration, what are the goals of the policy? Because oftentimes what we find, and when I talk to people who have very different views about immigration than I do, I ask them, well, what is it that you're going for? What are you trying to achieve? And most of the time, what I find is that people are concerned. They'll say something about jobs, or they'll talk about, you know, well, we need to know who's here. We want it to be secure. And I'll say, I also would like to know who is here, or not me personally, but we'd like to know who is in the country and who is not. But the solution to that problem is making it easier to get that information and to vet people, and not to try to shut people out of the U.S. through a more restrictive immigration system. One of the things that I think is also important, in addition to kind of those defining ends, and then really the debates just about the means or the policies that can get us there, the other thing that I think is really important for people to recognize, again, regardless of where they land on the ultimate, you know, idea of what does quote unquote optimal immigration look like, is you have to think about what are the incentives facing the people who are migrating. Because one of the things that my own work with my co-authors in this area has shown, people are going to migrate. So if you have made the decision that you are going to leave your country, that is not an easy choice to make. I'll give an example. We were, my husband and I were doing some international traveling in Guatemala a couple of years ago, and we happened to meet a family while we were there from Venezuela. And this family was a mother and a father, and they had three children with them. The oldest, I think, was 10, and the youngest was 3. And they had left Venezuela because the economy was collapsing, and they had, I think, if I remember correctly, they'd gone to Costa Rica. Their youngest had been born in Costa Rica, but then the work visa for the father did not get renewed. So they were trying to migrate to the U.S. to do what? Claim asylum, because again, that's the one path that they potentially have. But what really struck me about that was they had made a really difficult choice. I can think of very few, if any, parents who would say, yes, let me take my three young children to try to get them to another place that is very far away, where we don't speak the language, our degrees, if we have them, won't transfer or won't necessarily transfer. Let's take our entire life, uproot it, put our children in danger to try to get them to the U.S. I don't think that it's a very reasonable assumption to say that people are doing this without giving it a lot of forethought, nor do I think that that mother from Venezuela cares about her children any less than I care about my own children. So then I think about it as this: it must be really awful if you're willing to take on all of that risk and uproot your entire life to leave. And so if we start with that operating assumption that if people have decided to migrate, they are going to migrate, then the question becomes, okay, and what are the goals? Given that people are going to migrate, what then are the best policy options? And I think here, if you look at the data that we have and you look at the incentive structures as they are and as they potentially could be, that a more open immigration system would achieve a lot of the goals that people seem to have in common. So things like security, things like having a more efficient allocation of resources for Border Patrol, and doing or having a policy that allows us to vet people who come in a way that doesn't take 10 or, in the case of, say, like the Mexican visas, 30 years for us to do.
I think that's a really important point. And I think starting with that example of a family that is, you know, fleeing a socialist state where government policies of central planning and price controls and economic authoritarianism have resulted in an economy in collapse and a deeply illiberal and unsafe environment, is really useful because I think it does what economic reasoning at its best should do, which is provide us with a lens for analytically applied empathy. And what I mean by that in part is when we're doing economics, we're asking how other human beings are going to respond to a different set of incentives, which means that we need to think about what they value, what they believe, what they understand, and what they're going to perceive as costs and benefits. And so really taking other people's perspectives seriously is, I think, a really important part of economic research. So I really appreciate you bringing that into the foreground there. So what advice would you give to students and young scholars who want to pursue further research on these topics?
Well, first, I would say that I think this is a really ripe area for research, but it is a particularly challenging area for a lot of the reasons that I mentioned. So for like graduate students who are in economics specifically, the data limitations are going to present a problem for, I think, most people who are going to want to do kind of a statistically driven or like an econometric type of analysis that can make these issues tough. Now, that's not to say that like there isn't data out there. That's not to say that people don't study migration. But almost everything that we look at, and this is true for my own work as well, is on the US side specifically. And so when we were looking at to talk about the papers we began with, one of the limitations that we articulate about our analysis is that the deaths that we capture are only on the US side of the border because that's the data that we have. But we know that there's death on the other side of the border. We just don't have a relevant comparison. So we know that we're underestimating basically the total human cost. For students who have an international background, especially if they are native Spanish speakers and they read Spanish very well, then it would be really cool to see more analyses looking at migration, not from the US side, but from kind of that, we call it, kind of countries of origin. And I think that especially is a particularly potentially fruitful avenue. But there are certainly other disciplines who could research this as well. And there have been some really nicely done qualitative studies or historical analyses that have analyzed various factors contributing to migration. So things that we call like push factors and pull factors for immigration. And so there's a lot of work to be done there. My recommendation for students, to the extent that I'm qualified to give recommendations to students working on research, is to find a question that you are particularly interested in and passionate about. Find a method that is suitable for answering that question and then utilize that method. But the other thing that I think I would encourage students to think about is humility when walking into a research project. So one of the things that I know we found in our own work together, and certainly has been the case, not just for my work on immigration, but my work elsewhere, is you might go into a project thinking you're going to find one thing, or thinking that this is the path that you are going to take in order to answer the question that you want to answer. And you find out, whether it's due to data limitations or it's because you find out some new piece of information or some new, you know, policy that you were unaware of, that things can and do change within the context of research projects. And sometimes they change significantly. And so especially when you are looking at things as complex and interconnected as foreign policy, immigration, and then in my own case, you add war or conflict on top of that, then it requires a willingness to adapt. And so for people who are looking into this research area specifically, just encouraging patience, but also adaptability.
Treating research as a genuine process of discovery and learning rather than as, you know, writing an outline and then proceeding from there with that as a dogmatic guide to what you're doing.
Right. The way that I approach research. And this is actually probably even more true now than it was when I was a graduate student. I have an idea of what things are going to look like when I sit down to work on a paper or a book or some other type of research project. And sometimes I have the arguments very clearly outlined in my head. And other times things are not nearly as clear cut. And then sometimes I still will sit down with a very clear idea of what's happening in my head. And then as the paper progresses, I realize that I have to change what it is that I'm doing. And so it is, though, based on a genuine interest in understanding the question or the phenomenon that I'm interested in analyzing. The goal of the research is understanding. It's not one of control. So oftentimes, too, the way that I'll describe my own research is that it's often diagnostic and not prescriptive. So what I mean by that is it identifies or it highlights a variety of different issues or problems, but I'm always very careful about then going on and saying, and therefore we should have policy X, policy Y, and policy Z. Recognizing some of those things that you talked about earlier, every policy is going to have an unintended consequence involved with it, or there are benefits and costs associated with any policy. And I can't pretend to know what all of those costs and consequences are. So I guess one other piece of advice for graduate students would to be humble in terms of your implications, because it's probably worth, they're probably worthy of humility. We can't pretend usually to have really grand policy implications or to have hyper-specific policy recommendations as the result of our work.
And even to the extent that our work is really policy relevant, I think one thing that's useful about taking on this diagnostic role is we can sort of allow people to have a fuller understanding of the context they're working within, and then they can incorporate that understanding given their own values. So in that sense, we're giving people tools to expand their autonomy rather than acting as if we are rulers over them.
That's absolutely right. Again, the goal is understanding, not one of control or one of manipulation. I want people to be able to make their own decisions. People have different preferences. People have different goals than the ones that I do. And so my goal is to not tell people what their goals should be or what a policy ought to look like, but instead presenting them with relevant information about how things are, what the data tells us, what the data doesn't tell us, and then allow them to utilize that information to make choices.
Absolutely. So are there any suggestions that you would have for places that listeners could go if they want to learn more about the topics that we covered in today's conversation?
So certainly if people are interested in any of the papers that we were talking about, most of those are available online. People can go to my website. It's abigailrhall.com, or the papers are available on SSRN, or most of those papers are available. And certainly there are other folks that people could look at too. So some of my co-authors, for instance, that you've mentioned on those other papers, Michael Kuhn, who's with me at the University of Tampa, Cynthia Bansack, who's at St. Lawrence University, both of them have also written extensively on immigration. I'd also recommend the work of people like Ben Powell at Texas Tech or Alex Narasta at the Cato Institute, who also, I think, do really quality work analyzing various issues surrounding immigration. And importantly, they do it in ways that are not only, I think, interesting, but also accessible for people who may not be, you know, highly trained in terms of econometrics. And so I would definitely recommend their work.
Excellent. Abby, thanks so much for taking the time to talk with me today.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to the Hayek Program Podcast. To learn more about the research, scholars, and work of the Hayek Program, visit hayek.mercatus.org. For more information about graduate student fellowship opportunities for students at Mason as well as at universities across the globe, please visit students.mercatus.org. We hope you recommend students to our programs or consider applying yourself.